Hi everybody, I'm Isabella and I'm from the Anglican Alliance, and on behalf of the Anglican Alliance and Scottish Gates Action for Refugees who are hosting this online discussion, we'd like to really warmly welcome you to the conversation on Anglican and Episcopalian Church response to refugees in the UK. We are recording this conversation as a podcast, so also a really warm welcome to our listeners who are listening to this discussion after the event. This discussion is designed to share and learn from different contexts around the British Isles where Anglican and Episcopalian churches are responding to refugees in their communities. We're looking forward to hearing particularly around the themes of integration, partnership and sanctuary, and to hear stories from the grassroots, what initiatives and projects are working well locally, regionally and nationally, and where we can learn from and encourage one another, and also help in responding to the challenges of working in this area. So that's things like lack of funding, time, enthusiasm, attitudes of racism within church, wider society. We're going to follow a format for today's gathering that we will hear from three speakers for the first half of this discussion, and then the second half will be a time for questions and wider discussion. So do you have your questions ready? If you're not speaking, if you could mute your microphone, that would be great, so we don't pick up any background noise. So I think just to kick off, let's begin with our first speaker, and that is the Reverend Joan Lyon, who's from St Ninian's Aberdeen from the Scottish Episcopal Church. So Joan, over to you.
Thank you. I'd like to start, first of all, just with some personal context. I come from Glasgow. I was ordained into the Scottish Episcopal Church in 1996, and I've spent much of my life working with volunteers, both in a professional capacity and as a volunteer. I did VSO in Papua New Guinea in the 1970s, where I was definitely the stranger and was taken in very warmly. And then in the 2002, I moved to Luxembourg to work with the Anglican Church in Luxembourg, where about 98% of the congregation were migrants or expatriates, as we called ourselves. Amongst those were refugees and asylum seekers, mostly from Sierra Leone, Nigeria and Senegal. And we spent a lot of time giving them practical support in the form of house room, accompanying them to meetings, helping them through the legal process, health issues, which to them just seemed such a quagmire. So for me, a little prior understanding and experience can be useful, but not by any means essential, because it is about opening our hearts wherever we are and wherever we've been. But I've discovered with each new setting where we are placed, there's always more to learn. So I want to talk, first of all, a bit about how partnership is developing in Aberdeen. I came up to work in the Scottish Episcopal Church in September 2015 and discovered that preparations were already beginning to receive Syrian refugees through the Vulnerable Persons Resettlement Scheme, coming via the UNHCR from camps in Lebanon, Jordan and Egypt. The City Council had appointed a refugee project manager working within their community's housing and infrastructure department, and plus four project workers who were the key people designated to work with specific families. They, I have to say, have gone way beyond the call of duty, and it's been a fantastic experience on both sides. But there's been another tranche, and that's all the other non-council initiatives which have happened. Aberdeen doesn't have the same history of dispersal as many cities in England and certainly in Glasgow. But it is a very multicultural community through business, through the oil industry, and through our two universities. So strangers are not at all unusual. But this was a particularly new experience in many ways. So I went to a local ecumenical gathering as I settled in, clergy gathering every quarter, and I discovered that a new Syrian New Scots partner group had been formed. And this was a coalition of churches, the mosque, the city council, Aberdeen Council for volunteer organisations, the local food bank, Grampian Regional Equality Council, the local credit union, amongst others. And I became a member of that by virtue of the fact that our church had a grotty basement. We discovered that the city council, as the word got round that refugees were arriving, the city council were inundated with bags of donations from the public at large. People really opened their hearts, but they couldn't cope. I mean, they were kind of piling down the stairs. So we happened to have a rather grotty basement, which wasn't accessible for public use. And that, from that time until now, it's a lot tidier than it used to be, is a centre for the donations. So I think the important thing to remember there is that however small your resources, there's always something which you can put into the pot to offer. The group, this Syrian partner group, had made plans for welcoming events, for asking for appropriate donations of food, clothing, phones, bikes, and for money. And we set up a bank account with the credit union so that that could be accessed as agreed for specific projects. Like they had a big trip to Edinburgh and a day out, and that, you know, cost quite a lot of money with bus hire, etc. It was freezing cold, but they had a wonderful time. So things like that, but also to gather volunteers who worked in many, many ways. Initially, the most important thing was offering welcoming space with food. We had, you know, Syrian fruit where we could find it, and nuts, and the well-known Aberdeen rowies, a particular kind of bread roll. So it's just a beginning of integration. But also we needed volunteers and space to run language classes and childcare, because the families came along everywhere. Nobody wanted to be separated from anywhere. And even the children found their buggies a safe space. And if anything went wrong, they rushed into their buggies because that was all they had to hold on to. It was really interesting. So this was how this partnership started. And what surprised the city council was just what the churches had to offer. They really didn't know about the vast church network ecumenically across the city and the country. And this has been a transforming experience. So now sometimes the church is the first place that they go to for, what do we do about this? Or how can we organise that? Or do you have space for this? So, and the city council said, look, you need to tell people about what you're doing. You know, you need to have a PR department. And we kind of scratched our heads and thought, well, we don't really do this. And then I thought, well, why don't we do this? How can we spread the word without flying a flag? And it is just about, well, it's this kind of situation. It's writing articles. It's making contacts. It's talking about this project specifically in Aberdeen. And you'll all have your own projects and contexts. But that was a huge learning experience. And we know now that the churches are trusted to come up with good ideas, with people. They can smooth some molehills before they come into mountains. And, you know, that's been a huge learning experience. So a bit about what the churches, what the refugees are doing now in ways of integration. We now have about 84 people, not very many as ever, and people are making application to have numbers increased. That includes about 30 odd children of varying ages. New families just arrived last week and some more are coming next week. So we're looking at receiving up to about 100 people. Already about 13 adults are attending college. One is acting as the imam to a set of Syrians in a small town 30 minutes away. Some are volunteering. And all these things take so much more time to organise than you would think. You say, oh, I'll just phone so-and-so and it'll all work out. And I'm sure as Sally, our next speaker, will speak very fluently about, every detail counts. And these things always take longer. And sometimes, oh, gosh, this is just not worth it. But it is, because they don't have the capacity to find their own appropriate way through how we do things. So we need a lot of patience. And And that's a balance between thinking that we know what is best for somebody and perhaps running the danger of leaving the Syrians out of the equation altogether and just doing things for them. So it's doing things with them and taking the time, which in our situation means continual translation. Their English is improving, but very few of them had any English at all. And that remains one of the challenges. They have ordinary lives as much as anybody else. And some people might have been shocked by the fact that there are already some families who have split up. Some have had difficult neighbours. Not all of the families get on with each other. We have Kurds, we have Syrians, and a long history of very different communities. So it's, you know, they bring the normal challenges of everyday life. You know, just because we're helping them doesn't mean that they have to be perfect recipients for and forever grateful. So that's something that we really need to bear in mind. The overall experience cited by the Syrians is of enormous welcome and opportunity. I mean, that has not been without its hiccups, but they are very grateful for everything except the weather, I think, which they're still coming to terms with, and having to do Ramadan in the month of June when there's only about 2 hours of darkness. There's a question in relation to integration about the boundaries. When does the council or whatever your overarching body begin to let go? When do the volunteers step back? When do people, oh, that's my timer, I need to stop soon. but when do they become friendships, or when do they say, I've done my bit of volunteering, I'm stepping back now? And it's, you have to be quite clear about what kind of relationships we're working out, because the council will have to step back because their project workers will be deployed elsewhere. So that's an issue of sustaining this and sustaining them as far into integration as they want, because their future is uncertain. They have 5 years here, and I'm speaking about a very specific group of people, although we are discovering other asylum seekers who need just as much help, and that's been a useful part of the whole project. So these are some questions of people with an uncertain future, really. Towards that, we're looking towards developing Aberdeen as a city of sanctuary, and some of you will know about that. So I may get a chance to say a little bit more about that as our time together goes on. So that's where we are in Aberdeen at the moment. Thank you.
Joan, thank you very much. We're now going to hear from our second speaker, Reverend Sally Smith, who's in the Hanley Tea Ministry in the Diocese of Lichfield in the Church of England. So, Sally, over to you.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for inviting me. Listening to Joan, it's very interesting because the focus of our work is quite different, but of course there are lots of similarities. So I have had some involvement with the Vulnerable Persons Resettlement Scheme. But the majority of my work is for asylum seekers who are dispersed, horrible word, to Stoke-on-Trent. So Stoke is one of the dispersal cities where people will often come to. And usually the people that come to us have been in a hostel, either in Birmingham, Stone Road Hostel, or the name of the other one's escaped me, but it will come back to me in a minute. So Wakefield. And so many people who come to us have been told by people either in Stone Road or in Wakefield to come to our church for support when they get here. And I think really the context was that when I arrived as the vicar at St Mark's, already there was lots of need in the parish, which was mainly unmet. And we found that people were coming to church, and many of them were saying that when they'd left the country of origin, they'd been given advice by family members or people out in the community who'd said, if you're in trouble, go to a church because they will help you, which is really interesting because many of them, the vast majority, have come from Muslim background countries. So we find that we have great diversity. And the main challenges that we found people will come into the church with were things like isolation, language barriers, not being able to read a letter. And so they were turning up and asking for support. And what started very organically was, okay, let's open the door and welcome them and put the kettle on and the toaster. let's just be hospitable as Jesus would have us to do, and really had to grow as something much more organised and more of a structure around it with a board of trustees and all of that. So we've been on a journey over the past few years really of just reaching out as people within a church to forming an organisation, which is now two separate things. And there was huge challenges around that, how we did it. And unfortunately, it's been quite controversial as well. It's not been an easy journey. It's been a very, very challenging journey. And I learned quite quickly, I think, that the congregation that I'd got at the church, which is a post-industrial inner city church with a few elderly people who've got a particular view of what church should be and what worship is about, it was very challenging for those people to see the doors opened and people who may be Muslim or coming with all sorts of needs coming into the church. And as we attempted to meet those needs, I mean, Joan, it just made me smile, Joan, when you talked about bags of clothes, donations being dropped off. What that was one of the complaints, that the church looks like a jumble sale. It just doesn't look churchy anymore. So for people who are used to, you know, following a cruciferen on a Sunday morning and singing some songs to the organ, and there's like, you know, probably 10 warbly voices trying to sing along in this huge cavernous building. It was a bit great shock to hear different languages coming in and people wanting help and tables, you know, that had helped, nice crosses and candles suddenly being loaded up with donations for people. It was a huge challenge. And some of those people have now gone and worship in other churches within our team, which didn't go down particularly well, as you can imagine. So it's been very difficult in that context. But yeah, one of the things that we found that as we've opened the doors, we've found people who want to come and work alongside us. So the church has become a hub. So now on a Wednesday morning, we have a drop-in and we will have probably 120, 130 people will come for support. And that will be families. Probably 20 of those people could be new on any one Wednesday. So new people who've come along, who've been brought to live into the city, who've been signposted to us by GPs, by G4S, interestingly, who are have the contract with the Home Office for housing people, the NHS nursing team. Stoke-on-Trent is very fortunate in being, I think, the only place in the country where we have an NHS team dedicated to asylum seekers and refugees who work very closely with us. And one of those nurses, Sarah, is a mental health specialist, and she has direct access into the referral systems and things. So that really helps to smooth the way for people. We work with the children's centres, so we run stay and play activities during the drop-in. We have food support. We have English classes. We work quite closely with the local universities, Peel University Law Department. Their students come along and do placements with us. We have social workers on placement with us. We work closely with the YMCA, which again is in the parish and the board member there, so that works very well. They deliver training for us. And so we're finding that the many, many needs that people are presented with, we're able to meet holistically, not because we are a church, but because we're working together with community partners and other people are getting on board. And we're all bringing, like Joan said, bringing everything to the party, if you like. You know, we have a building, but people come and use that building. And we've now opened another drop-in in another town where G4S are starting to house people in the Longton area. So we have a drop-in there in the Methodist Church. And so I think what we're doing is not particularly saying we've got something amazing that can solve all the problems of asylum seekers and refugees, but what we're saying is come and join us, or come along and talk to us, come and chat to us, and all working together, we can make a difference. And that's been the really important thing, that it's been partnership working. But again, we had to do that in a way that wasn't traditional Anglican PCC planning mode, and to enable something to take on a life of its own that was going to be overseen and contributed by people who'd all got the same passion, really, and we weren't having to compete with other issues that the Church of England traditionally has got itself embroiled in, really, that we could take this particular issue, quite urgent, away from the day-to-day stuff that the Church of England expects us as vicars or as ministers to bother ourselves with, if you like. And I think it's been a massive learning curve for me, and it's been one of those things about deciding what's important and what's what would be good or what's urgent and what's necessary. And I'm starting to feel, you know, as you sort of reflect theologically on this sort of thing that you're involved with, that maybe each generation, the church has a big issue that it needs to deal with and it has some choices to make. And we have a link with Germany in our diocese, and so we share with our German partners. And I know when we go over and share Advent with them, or they come to us to share Advent one, we talk a lot about what's happened politically around Europe and the way the church has responded to that. And we know that, you know, in the Second World War and the lead up to the Second World War, the church particularly had some decisions to make as to how it responded to the rise of anti-Semitism, and we all know where that led, and the church doesn't have a great track record really of speaking out and being active in that context. And I think maybe this is our challenge for our generation in the church. How do we respond to the needs of asylum seekers and refugees? How do we not just respond practically in a way that Joan's doing and we're doing, but how do we challenge as well, and how do we encourage our church, our worldwide church, to invest our passion, our resources, and to say this is what we are, you know, this is a really important issue that's affecting all of us, and we need to direct some of our energy into that. I know we've got the General Synod approaching, and I'd like to think that for the Church of England particularly, that this is something that's really high on the agenda. We're struggling with a crumbling building, we've got water leaking in, we've got a collapsing ceiling, we've just had parts of the church sectioned off so we can continue to use the building. It would be wonderful if the Church of England was able to say, yes, we recognise the value of the work that's happening, we recognise the great need, we recognise that our vicar's time shouldn't be drained in trying to apply for grants to repair Victorian buildings that are well past their sell-by date. But, you know, so that resources could be directed really to the work that we're doing and to help improve and build on the will that's there, the goodwill that's there to do it. And, you know, just one very quick story, just an example really of how we've been able to practically help. A lady walked through the doors of our church 2.5 years ago. She was Syrian with a toddler, with a one-year-old toddler, and she was absolutely devastated. She could speak no English and I could speak no Arabic, but with the help of other people at the drop-in, we were able to hear her story. And basically, four older children had been left in Bulgaria by traffickers, and she found herself here with her youngest child. She was in touch with them by phone. They'd run out of money for credit, they'd got no food. And just through the wonders of Facebook Messenger, I was able to contact a church in Bulgaria to say, is there anything we can do? They contacted a colleague in another city, the city where the children were. And within hours, we'd been able to find some food, take some food to those children. And after a couple of days, I flew out to Bulgaria, found these kids, took them to a colleague, a friend who I'd worked with previously in Bulgaria, who looked after those children for a year until we were able to get them over here to the UK. And they're now reunited as a family. Still legal challenges, still stuff that they're going through. But that's just an example, really, of how our church is working together, and nationally, internationally, ecumenically, can really make a very practical difference in the life of one family.
Sally,
my time is...
Yeah. we need more time, don't we? Sally, thank you very, very much. So we've heard online from Joan in Aberdeen, from Sally in Stoke, and we're now going to go to Aled, who is in Abergavenny, and Aled is from Church Together in Wales.
Oh, Aled, I think you might have muted your...
We can't hear you now. That's great.
I am now unmuted. Just to give you a background, I'm a Church in Wales clergyman, originally from North Wales, but my current role is I'm Chief Executive of Cotillion Churches Together in Wales. And it was back, I think, in 2001, when I had a role in Cotillion as a Church's Liaison Officer to the new National Assembly here in Wales, that I was asked to go into Cardiff Prison, and there to see some asylum detainees that were kept there under remand conditions. And I got very involved through that process in trying to get them out, get them released, and was rather incensed by the way in which they were treated, as indeed Welsh civic society was, and churches were across the board. I then learned very quickly, in my case, it was useful for me, to deploy all the possibilities of our devolved National Assembly in terms of holding inquiries through committees, getting people from the immigration services down to explain their conduct. And at that time, I also became involved with a charity, a small refugee charity in Wales called Displaced People in Action. And through that charity, I've been chair of it now for about 16 or 17 years. We began some very, very innovative programs, I think, worldwide. One of the original schemes that we had back in 2001-2002 was to retrain refugee doctors and other medical staff. We're dealing now very much with dentists as well. And we celebrated recently the fact that we crossed the threshold of 90 GMC registered doctors. That is that we've taught them English, we've taken them through the PLAB 1 and PLAB 2 exams, we negotiated with the Cardiff Deanery and the NHS in Wales that they should have designated posts within our health service, and that has enabled us now to get 90 of them trained through for working in the NHS. One of them who was in the original batch back in 2002 recently became a consultant up in Wrexham. So we're thrilled for them that they've been able to do that work very quickly and very well. Like the rest of you, I've been very much involved as well with the dispersal system. And we tried our best at those times to give people legal advice. But the early focus was very much on the care of children and getting people to participate in sport. So we tried a lot of issues around football teams. We took people through the Duke of Edinburgh scheme. And we got a lot of mountains in Wales. I don't like the weather, but the mountains tend to be quite good. So we took a lot of them out to the countryside and gave them that degree of help and support. The work with children started a number of years ago with support from Children in Need, BBC Children in Need. And that program has been ongoing for many, many years. And we heard a report just this week that currently we've helped in the current batch about 81 children to acclimatise and to get used to being in the UK and to find a way of enjoying life and to settle down in school. The contract by a number of local authorities, Bryn Gwent, Turbine, Monmouth, Caerphilly, to receive the Syrians as they come in. And we found that to be both innovative and has been good and encouraging, but it's also been quite a learning curve because the Syrian deployed through that programme wouldn't perhaps be the people that you would get in camps in Lesbos or the borders of Idomeni. Many of them were well settled in places like Turkey and in Lebanon and other countries. So we had to, in a way, handle their sense of expectation. But on the whole, it's gone very, very well. The children have settled very well in Welsh schools. One of our children in one of the local authorities came first in a class recently, and that was immensely encouraging. And we've also received recently some vulnerable children. So as you can imagine, we have to look after them in a very special way. That experience, I think, has given us a sense of awareness of to be careful, particularly with the community sponsorship scheme. We know that other Anglican partners...
I've lost sound.
We've lost you for a second, Aled.
His screen is frozen from my point of view.
Yeah, mine too.
Aled, you may come back.
I think he's dropped out significantly now.
Oh, that's a shame. Aled, you're back. We did lose you for a second there. We can hear you. We can hear you a bit now. It may just be a bad connection. I think let's, well, we may get Aled back. I hope we do. But just while we're waiting for Aled, can we just take a question or two from, you know, potentially John or Alan, Ursula? Is there a particular question you'd like to put forward to Joan and Sally?
I think we're back.
Aled, again. Okay.
Yeah. Hold on. If I could just carry on for a little while, the one big issue that I think that I want to raise with partners here is that a number of years ago, about 8 or 9 years ago, Cytuned Churches Together in Wales, which is the equivalent of Churches Together in England and ACTS in Scotland, we decided that we would push the Welsh Government and key stakeholders to try and make Wales the first nation of sanctuary, building very much on the City of Sanctuary concept. And DPIA led a Cities of Sanctuary dynamic for about 2 or 3 years with a great deal of money from the big lottery. That is now coming to the end of the second year. But we are hoping soon that we will actually gain accreditation as probably the world's first nation sanctuary. We're in the process of actually identifying what those thresholds would be to make sure that they're meaningful. But we've already got buy-in from the Welsh Government, from a number of local authorities. And throughout Wales now, we've got 10 groups on top of the 3 cities that we already have. We've got 10 groups buying into that dynamic. So we're really excited by that. And obviously, faith communities, churches, and indeed Anglican churches in particular, will be very involved with formulating that for the future.
Brilliant. Aled, thank you very much. And I think that's a real sort of a challenge of, you know, a dream of actually, I hope more than a dream, a reality of actually wearing, you know, in the British Isles, where could we all aim at and where could we build on the partnerships that we can hear about at national, regional and local level? I think, thank you very much. We're going to go to a time of questions. So, you know, have your questions ready. If you'd like to ask a question, if we can see you, just raise your hand. Like, you know, we can see John. If we can't see you, either reveal yourselves on a webcam or type a message, and David and I can see messages coming in for questions. So if you can't speak at all, you can write one or just come in with a question. And it's questions for our 3 speakers, but also for more general discussion. And just going back to those areas of, you know, what can we learn from one another? Where can we encourage each other? How can we respond to the challenges that we're facing? How can we respond to challenge, build sustainability, all of those sorts of things? So are there any questions online? Anybody got a burning question? Joan, I can't see you. You have a question.
Have I lost? I just wanted to pick up on the bit that when Aled lost Aled's voice because he was beginning to speak about the community sponsorship scheme. And we missed what came after that, and that's, I wondered what was happening in Wales about that, with the reception of vulnerable children.
Great. Aled, did you hear that? Would you be able to...
About 5 or 6 years now, I've been chair of Wales Strategic Migration Partnership, which is Home Office funded and led. Can you hear us? Yeah. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
So we've been encouraged to take the community sponsorship scheme on board. But as I was saying, I think there is some reticence in terms of Welsh civic society about the scheme. It may be a good thing of itself, and as I said, we've got this conference in Aberystwyth where we'll be exploring it from a Welsh civic point of view, looking forward to that. But I think the lessons for the Syrian resettlement programme taught us that local authorities are very valuable if anything goes wrong in terms of housing, in terms of health and in terms of education. They have a great deal of resource available to them that possibly we need to think through very carefully with the community sponsorship scheme. And the question that those of us who've got experience of service delivery in this area would say is, well, you know, what happens if things go seriously wrong? And I think those issues have got to be thought through. We're not saying don't do them, because they will obviously help a lot of people, but they have to be thought through very carefully.
Thank you. That's really interesting.
David?
Just to say a couple of points of information. One is, I know that the Church of England are looking to, are recruiting a staff member to be based at Church House who will be responsible for developing the community sponsorship program across the Church of England. So that might be a really good point of learning for us all. And then the second point is, there's a European ecumenical group called the Church's Commission for Migrants in Europe, and they're organising a conference in September on community sponsorship or private refugee sponsorship schemes in Europe, and lots of different churches will be present and attending. So I imagine over the next 3 months, 4 months or so, there'll be maybe a lot more of this discussion going on. So I think it's quite useful that it's been raised in this way. So thank you very much. I do also know that Martin Kay, who I presume is Martin Kettle from the Church of England, is also on the call. And yes. I just turned the mic on. So Martin, do you want to say something?
Can you hear?
Yes.
Yes, yeah.
You can. Excellent.
Can you hear me? Yeah.
We can hear Martin.
Yeah, I'm just saying, you know, one of the things that we... Can you hear me? Yeah.
Alid, go ahead.
Sorry?
Alid, if you go ahead, and then we'll...
Okay, one of the things that we have to think through very carefully here is the balance between the spontaneous arrivals, which is the model that most of us are used to in the UK, and more specific programmes like the Syrian resettlement programme. The numbers, I think, would say that overwhelmingly the numbers would be still with the dispersal areas and the dispersal system. And that's where the real need, because there's considerable upfront funding for the Syrian resettlement programme that perhaps isn't there for the dispersal system. And I'm a bit concerned that we might have a first class and a second class system for our refugees. And the other thing as well is, I think we've got to be very careful that we don't give power to the elbows of those who say we'd much rather that all these people stayed within the context, say in Turkey or in Lebanon, and that we would cherry pick the people who come here, because the burden on those countries, in the Middle East in particular, are very, very considerable, and we have to be mindful of the politics of this issue.
Hello. Yes. Hello, it's Martin Kettle here.
Martin, go ahead.
I can say hello, but I'm also here with Nadine Daniel, who is her first day today working with the Church of England, as David mentioned, as the National Refugee Welcome Coordinator. So Nadine is here with me. I don't think you can see her picture, but I'm sure the meeting would be improved if you could see both of us.
Yeah.
Everything that Aled says rings a lot of bells and has been said elsewhere, particularly by the recent APVD report and so on. But we are going all out for community sponsorship, as well as the kind of brilliant work that Sally and others are involved in. There are opportunities, we think, which it brings. You mentioned that local authorities have a lot of resource, and we wouldn't countenance any community sponsorship being undertaken without a close partnership with the local authority, and without working, knowing that the safeguarding and the risk issues were completely covered. And so working within the Home Office community sponsorship scheme is a good guarantor of that, in a way, because all of that has to be, all of those criteria have to be satisfied before one can go ahead. So we see it as very much a both ands. Many Anglican parishes obviously involved with people in dispersal and with the spontaneous arrivals, who indeed are vital, because there are so many more of them. And there are, I've certainly met dioceses where some people are very reluctant to join a community sponsorship, because they see it as partly because of the lack of additionality to the resettlement scheme in terms of the 20,000 target, but also in terms of deflecting from that original scheme. But we're just trying to go for it. The resource that is added in community sponsorship is time, basically, and people and communities and the wraparound effects. And we worked obviously a lot with the Canadians, who have 25 years experience of that, and a deputation are coming over next week from Canada, doing roadshows with former refugees around the country. So we're really hopeful that community sponsorship can emerge as in no way replacing other work, but as adding to it and bringing in other parts of the country, which so far I've had difficulty in engaging with it. So we see it as very missional and very much a way of engaging communities. And the Canadians have found that one of the strongest impacts has been on community development and integration locally, as people have discovered they can welcome refugee families in, and that transformed their community. I don't know if Nadine wants to say anything else.
My background is working with people who've been dispersed up in Liverpool. Sonia, I'm very, very aware of the work that you've been doing. But I've also been involved in St. Monica's Flixton project, which was the first parish church to take on community sponsorship. And it's clearly showing that the add-ons that we can give community sponsorship is very much the way forward. And it is very much a way of resetting the national dialogue, which is pretty poisonous at the moment. And it's also a way of the church being able to be visibly doing something rather than talking about it. Because I think at the moment, the problem is people say, well, the church are just talking about it. Let's see you doing something. And this is something we can be seen to be doing.
Thank you both. David, respond?
No, just to say that John had a question. Ooh, I think.
Okay, John, you got sharper eyes than me. John, do you have a question? Oh.
Yes, thank you. Sorry, and it doesn't quite flow on from what Martin was saying, but there may be a connection with Nadine's work. And it was a question for Sally, really. Sally, I was just wondering, in Lichfield Diocese, how your work in the church, how is that connected with other churches? I was just interested to hear more whether there was a kind of a diocesan-wide approach to refugees, or whether there was a, you know, ecumenical churches, diocesan-wide or region-wide approach to this, or whether it's just your church on its own.
It's interesting because we get a lot of support now, both ecumenically and from other churches within the diocese. And our bishop, Bishop Michael Lipgrave, who came from London, has now become he's becoming the chair of our project. And so we're getting a lot of support, much wider support that it's been building up gradually. But I think we're now at the stage where we can say we are getting the support. I think when we first started, it was a little bit iffy. It was a little bit out on the edge. And there was a little bit of sitting back and watching what was happening. But I feel that now Bishop Michael is not as our chair, as our patron. So he's really supporting what we're doing. But I think the other thing is that we get support from the Methodist churches locally, from the Catholic Church, and even from other groups who are not connected to the church. So we have atheists who give us money monthly. A lot of the work we do is around destitution, so housing people. We're currently housing about 20 people. And we have people buying a property for us, which is very cheap in Stoke, who let us use the building. And that's, again, something as part of the NACOM network that we want to grow and to build on. So, yes, I think what's happening, I think ecumenically, the barriers are coming down. I think as we all join together to put our hands to the task, I think it's taking down the walls that are between the churches and between parishes as well. But there's another level, I think, it's affecting the church, which again is growing another national network in terms of the people that are actually joining our churches through the support that they're getting as they come in as asylum seekers. So there's something particularly happening nationally in the Anglican Church around the Persian community. And again, I'm part of that sort of national conversation we recently had a conference up in Leeds, how the Anglican Church can welcome Persians particularly. That's not to say that they're favourites, but I would say 85% of my congregation is now Persian. And so it's how do we as churches respond to that as well. So it's on many different levels, really. It's very interesting because it's raising all sorts of issues, which it's like living through the Book of Acts. As we read the Book of Acts, we say, oh, yeah, we're dealing with that, you know, and it's, again, is she favouring the Persians? Are they getting more translation than the Kurdish people? And, you know, lots and lots of interesting challenges that we're facing.
Thank you, Sally. Can I just to jump in, if you're not speaking, just to mute your microphone because we're picking up some background noise. Brilliant. It all sounds lovely and quiet now. Having just said that, are there other questions or points for discussion that people want to throw in?
And it's Alan here in Belfast. I have a question if nobody else wants to go forward. I'm kind of wondering a bit about, it's kind of chicken and egg this, but in terms of whether the, as church groups get together and combine across a town or a city to help out, does it tend to be within the one denomination, or does kind of existing ecumenical links tend to bring forward people from all kinds of diverse faith backgrounds to work on the problem? Or I suppose the counter is whether actually just working on refugee issues together then develops ecumenism and actually supports that. So I'm kind of wondering which way round it comes and whether actually it is ecumenical or whether largely it tends to be within one denomination or a kind of existing networks of churches that are very, very local to each other.
I would say it's a bit of both. at Stoke-on-Trent, where I am, was the city that I grew up in. So I've got, and I've come from a large family, and so have lots of friends in different denominations. And I think that when I started to do what I was doing at St. Mark's, it was because, like, my daughter's fiance is the youth pastor at the local Methodist church, and somebody else goes to a local Pentecostal church. And I think the two sort of go hand in hand, and it's hard to say which was first, really. It is like chicken and egg. But I think as the work becomes more publicised, and we have very good links with the media, Radio Stoke, and also the Evening Sentinel, which is our local newspaper, they often print very positive things, and we get lots of access to local media, to Radio Stoke, to go in and talk about the work that we're doing. So I think it's everything coming together, and it's hard to say. For me personally, it would be hard to say what was the one key, because I think it's just lots of things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sally.
Yeah, can I just chip in on that one as well? From our point of view, just from my point of view, we've done it across the board in the sense that we've got many churches beginning in Ulster, that's the way we would do it. We work really hard as well to make sure that other faith communities, particularly the Islamic community, are on board. But we've created, particularly on Cardiff and Swansea, indeed Wrexham in North Wales, there's a real dynamic with civic group as well, such as Citizens UK, TCC up in North Wales. And we have found this being a real leveller of bringing people together in cooperation. And that has overflowed, very interesting from our point of view, in terms of being able to meet very quickly, for example, at times of crisis. So when we had that incident where a man from Cardiff, who lived in Cardiff, drove a van over those individuals leaving a mosque in London the other day, we were able to come together very, very quickly, not only as faith groups, but as civic groups, to hold vigils and work together, and for refugees and the asylum seekers, particularly in that dynamic, to have their own voice. So we do it in a very holistic, ecumenical way across the board.
Thank you, Alice. And Joan, can we hear from you?
I think just echoing a bit what Sally said, it depends what your starting point is. I mean, if there's not much ecumenical cooperation, then I think a need can be put out, say, like, do we need 20 duty covers, or, you know, whatever it is, something practical. And most people respond to that, and that therefore brings people together. I mean, I got involved because we had a good, what was called the Dawnside Christian Partnership, which was a very ecumenical group, all happened to be interested in the same thing as the Syrian refugees came. So it's looking at what you've got in your hands and working to develop that. But I think a plea for something specific at the beginning, rather than just another talking shop, because one of the biggest challenges, certainly for clergy and a lot of lay people, is time. We don't have enough time, and you know, we have to prioritise. So it's starting with what you've got there.
Great, thank you all. Further questions and just points of discussion? David, I think
I'd have one if no one else wants to jump in, but it's really as someone who works at a national office of a church-based organisation, I've really seen my role as being something of serving local churches and the kind of leadership and coordination in this work. So I suppose my question is, what would be helpful from people doing my kind of work, or even Isabel's kind of work with the Anglican Alliance, for people like maybe you, particularly maybe Sally and Joan, working at a local parish level or a local church level?
If I can kick off there, one of the things I think is important is about education, and that's education of the receiving congregations or the receiving community, because there is so much misinformation. And I mean, via David, thank you, David, I took an online course with the University of Roehampton called Migration Matters, 6-week online course, and I have learned a huge amount, and I have a huge amount of reading to do. And I realised that I actually have learned quite a lot in the last year, but some people coming to it fresh haven't a clue. I mean, you know, particularly dealing with people from another faith, is this about their culture or is it about their religion? And within that culture, where is the diversity? So it's so easy to stereotype. And I think if we can be informed better and inform our congregations, either by Bible study presentations, getting together, whatever works in your context, that's really valuable. So resources to do that would be useful. I'm starting to gather them myself, but I think that's important.
One of the things that I would say is that I think as a church, we need to be unembarrassed about saying this is an amazing opportunity for mission.
Yeah.
And I think we get very awkward about that as Anglicans, don't we? I think we don't want anybody to think that we're being, we'll talk about being missional because that's a trendy buzzword. But if we then start to put that practically, how is that working as we welcome asylum seekers and refugees and people coming from Muslim backgrounds, that then starts to feel very awkward for people. One of the things that we do, you know, we run our regular baptism courses and regularly people want to get baptised and confirmed. And I'm very unembarrassed about that. I don't make any apologies for being public about it, you know, and talking about it, because I actually think our core mission is to introduce people to the love and the welcome and the hospitality of Jesus. We do that very practically as we welcome asylum seekers and refugees in the very many contexts that we've talked about today. But personally, I would like to see the Church of England being much more open about that. Because one of the things I've discovered, particularly for people who are coming as asylum seekers from Iran, is that they already have a predisposition to love Jesus. And there's something happening, the Shia Muslim clerics in Iran are very concerned about, because many, many of the young people are turning to Jesus. The house church movement is growing. And as they try to clamp down on that, people are coming out and they're seeking asylum. And they are filling, or they will, the potential to populate and bring new life to all of our churches. And Iranian people particularly seem to have this predisposition to love Jesus. And I think a lot of it's to do with their poetry, that Sa'di, Rumi, the poets that for centuries have been sort of feeding the minds and the souls of the Iranian people. And Jesus, Masih, is talked about in all of those poems and lots of that literary work. And so it's very easy for a Shia Muslim who's come from Iran to come to a church and to worship Jesus, because they already seem to have a love for him. And I think that's something that we really need to begin to understand and really, I won't say take advantage of, because that would, you know, make it sound like we're taking advantage of people, and we're clearly not. But we do want to introduce people to Jesus, and we do want to introduce people to the worship of Jesus. And so I think, yes, we're very practical, and we offer practical support for people, but we want them to meet Jesus too. And I think we need to be unembarrassed about that, especially when we're working with the Muslim community. I mean, my parish here, my church school, 95% of the children are Pakistani Muslim, and my neighbours are Muslim. But still, you know, they're very aware of the fact that I'm baptising Muslims, and 27 former Muslims were confirmed 2 weeks ago at St. Mark's Church. And there hasn't been the backlash so far that we might fear could happen.
I think that's really interesting, because as we are trying to work within the Syrian Partners Group, I wouldn't want to sort of upset the mosque, as it were, to put it bluntly. And we have to tread very carefully when we're trying to work equally around the table. But there are a number of the refugees who are non-practicing Muslims, and others who are very faithful practicing Muslims. So, you know, within that group there's a range, and it's up to us to say, well, this is what we offer, and up to them to respond. So perhaps we should be offering more.
And that's been one of the
So, Sally, we'll hear from you, and then Aled after. We can see you.
Yeah.
That's been one of the advantages for me of saying that we have Sanctus, which is the support group for refugees, and we have the church, and I'm the leader of Sanctus, but I'm also the vicar of the church. So I can say very clearly to our Muslim partners, Muslim neighbours, Muslim friends, that people come to Sanctus and we have Muslim volunteers there, and the Muslim community bring people to us and refer people to us. But I'm very open when I say I am also the vicar, and if people want to pray with me, there's space for that to happen, and we worship on Sunday, and we would welcome people to come and worship with us, even if they're Muslim. And I just talk about that really, really openly in a very unembarrassed, unashamed way. And they accept it. And they, you know, you win some, you lose some, seems to be the attitude.
Yeah, just to say from our point of view, going back to the original question, we have a...
Oh, Aled, we've lost you. Aled, if we get you back, we'll come back to you. We can't hear you.
We're fortunate in Wales in the sense that we have a faith community forum that meets twice a month, an environment where that is possible without being, in a sense, aggressive over proselytisation of very vulnerable people. I think it has worked well on the whole, but as you can imagine, there is sometimes a very bad reaction when people become Christians from being Muslims, and I guess the other way around as well. But that's one of the things that we've been able to do from a national Welsh point of view that might help locally, particularly parts of cities like Cardiff and Swansea.
Great. Thank you, Aled. We're almost out of time, but John, we have just time for just to hear your question.
It was just a really quick question around Islamic communities and mosques. I'm wondering whether there's an opportunity to build some connections around campaigning and advocacy, because I noticed that Islamic Relief's focus for Ramadan was all about refugees, as was Christian Aid's, and I just thought, you know, there is perhaps some space for talking with communities about how that can be done, which might helpfully build some bridges.
Yeah, thank you, John. Would anyone like to respond to that from the speakers or the group?
Yeah, just from our point of view, we've been working very hard to build a really good relationship with the mosques. During the height of the Ramadan, I visited two over a couple of days, particularly when tensions were high. And friendships really deepened, and that is of immense value. And I think the way in which they've been able, for example, to pick up destitute asylum seekers in a way that probably the Christian church would struggle with has been very good as well. So there's one guy recently turned up in a Methodist church, and we had to contact the Muslim Council for Wales, and they were able to look after him very, very well within this old faith community. And we wouldn't have been able to do that if the relationships weren't as robust as they should be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Joan or Sally, do you want to respond?
I'd say that we also have a very good relationship with our local Muslim community and with the mosque. In fact, our local councillor is on the board of the mosque. And one of the things that we've been doing is twice a year trying to do a unity faith event. The first one was at the local college, where we all came together, the Jewish community, the Muslim community, the Christian community. We invited some Sikhs and Hindus, but they're not significant enough in numbers, really, and they weren't able to make it. But what we did, we planted tulips for world peace, and it was really a beautiful occasion. And then we, instead of, you know, we read the passage of Jesus washing his disciples' feet, and after we'd planted these bulbs, we washed each other's hands, and we had some lovely, lovely photographs of people of different faiths washing each other's hands as we signed these pots for that brought the tulips of world peace together, and they grew. And then the second event that we did together was a great get-together event a couple of weeks ago. And again, that was amazingly just joyful, really. And so those relationships are there, maybe not on a structural level, but on a very practical people on the ground level. And I think that's one of the things within Stoke on Trent, that we don't have huge structures that bring people together. That's always been probably a little bit vulnerable, or we've had people in post and it just doesn't work very well. But what's happening is that we have real people with real relationships on the ground saying, let's just do this together.
Mm-hmm. Can I just add briefly, we have some structure in Aberdeen. There's a new multi-faith forum, which is taking off. We've had several meetings and looking at a way forward. But also the Provost of St Andrew's Episcopal Cathedral in Aberdeen is very close to the Muslim community, because after 9/11, when he was rector of a different church in Aberdeen, the Muslims were praying in the street in the rain after 9/11, and he brought them into the church saying, for goodness sake, come into the dry, you can use my church. And that's been a continuing good relationship with the people in the mosque there. So we need to foster these things. So that was a very practical thing, as well as something that's a bit more structural.
Thank you, Joan. I'm afraid we're out of time, but it has been an incredibly rich conversation and just lots of practical things coming through and really valuable. We'll have this to listen to again online so we can share this with others. But just a really big thank you, Joan, Sally and Alid, for your time and just offering your experience and wisdom to all of us. And thank you for everybody who's joined online and will be listening to this after the event on the podcast. So thank you, and have a good rest of the day, and it's bye for now.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.